Okay, Deborah, over to you.
Hello, I'm Deborah Swinglehurst. I'm a GP and I'm a teaching fellow at UCL. Please use your next button at the top right of your screen to find slide 2. My objectives for today's presentation are to describe the information needs of primary care clinicians, to describe some of the barriers to meeting these information needs, explain how information might be used to support evidence-based healthcare, and to draw out some lessons which may be relevant to the design of information services which aim to facilitate evidence-based healthcare. I'm also interested in exploring teleconferencing as a way of sharing learning and experience. I have enclosed a reference list at the end of the presentation, and the reference numbers are shown in brackets throughout. Please click the next button to view slide 3. So why is this topic important? First and foremost, clinicians in primary care have to be able to care for any problem which any patient brings to them. This gives some idea of the enormity of their need for knowledge to support patient care and continuing professional development. There will always be a new problem that general practice hasn't dealt with before. It's full of surprises. Add to this the fact that new knowledge is created daily and more information is readily available on the internet than ever before. The problem is that as more information becomes available, the challenge of finding the right information becomes even greater. Many clinicians feel overwhelmed by the plethora of guidelines and journals that land either on their doormat or in their electronic inbox daily. So navigating through the jungle that is information is no mean feat. Not only is the information expanding, but the roles of many clinicians within the primary healthcare team are also expanding. Many GPs are taking on roles that were traditionally those of specialists in the hospital, whilst still having to retain their generalist skills. Equally, nurses are taking on roles which have traditionally been the domain of doctors. This obviously creates new information needs. What's more, the delivery of healthcare more generally is changing. The primary care-led NHS places new demands on the delivery of information services. Information services must be delivered to where they are needed. The internet clearly offers huge potential for delivery of information to the desktop, but as we will see later, finding information still demands time and skills which many clinicians do not have. In my view, the skills of the information specialist need to migrate out of the hospital and postgraduate library. In the town where I practice, there are some very basic obstacles to accessing library services. At a practical level, there is no parking for a start, but then there isn't really the time to get there within a busy GP day anyway. Finally, the resourceful patient. Some of you may have listened to Muir Gray's lecture on this topic in a previous session. Our patients can and do find all the information they might ever need about their condition on the internet. This brings new information challenges to the clinician. To assume that patients might know less than we do is not only a dangerous assumption, but is often simply untrue. I'm sure you can think of 101 other reasons why this is an important topic, but as a practicing clinician, these seem to be the most powerful. Please click next to move on to slide 4. Slide 4 shows an example of a typical primary care scenario, which I will use to illustrate primary care information needs. Mrs. Brown attends surgery. She is 78, has been fit and well all her life, and is the main carer of her husband, who has been wheelchair-bound since a stroke last year. She recently developed indigestion and reluctantly had an endoscopy, which she found distressing. The gastroenterologist told her she has Barrett's esophagus. He explained she would need to have endoscopies every 2 years because of her risk of getting cancer. He also advised her to take a medicine, lansoprazole, all her life. She is extremely anxious about all of this. Only last year, her brother died of cancer. Please click on to slide 5. I would now like you to take part in an interactive exercise. Imagine that you are the primary care clinician trying to help this patient. I would like you to consider what information would assist you in managing this patient. Use the Ask a Question button at the top left of your screen to submit some of your questions. You will have 3 minutes for this exercise. As Fran said, the line will go quiet, but don't worry, you won't be cut off. If you click on to next slide to move on to slide 6, you can read the scenario again.
Okay, that's 1 minute of your 3 used up. And you've got 1 minute left now. That's your 3 minutes used up, so back over to you, Deborah.
Thank you, Fran. Thank you for taking part in this exercise. And we have quite a lot of questions here. I'll ask you to click on to next slide to move on to slide 7, and I will share some of the questions with you as we look at that slide. We can divide information needs into 3 broad groups. In the top left box, we see published information. Any published information relevant to the group of patients with Barrett's esophagus. Gathering information of this sort will help us to manage this particular patient, but might also inform our management of other patients with Barrett's esophagus. So this will include high quality research evidence, but other examples of useful published information might include good patient information leaflets or information about patient support groups. So you submitted quite a lot of examples which might fall into this category, and I'll give you some of these now. First of all, what is Barrett's esophagus? And what is the risk of developing cancer if you have Barrett's esophagus? What would be the outcome for this particular patient with and without the surveillance endoscopies? Indeed, will regular endoscopies have any significant outcome? Also, as she found endoscopy a distressing procedure, are there alternative ways of managing this patient? The remaining two boxes show information which is unique to this particular patient. First of all, the patient health record in the bottom left box. In fact, I don't think anybody submitted a question that might fall neatly into this category, but as a clinician, the sort of questions we might have, which would involve looking into the patient's health record, might include, for example, what did the endoscopist's report say? Mind you, I would say it's quite frequent that the patient will reach us before the endoscopist's report, but we might want to look in the notes to find what the findings were. And perhaps more particularly, what did the endoscopist communicate to her? Other things we might find in this category include, for example, does Mrs. Brown have any other significant history? For example, does she smoke? Does she have any drug intolerances? So this is important contextual information. Finally, the box on the right represents information regarding the specific patient's values, concerns, and preferences. We know that Mrs. Brown found the procedure of the endoscopy quite distressing. So how does Mrs. Brown feel about having further endoscopies? Mrs. Brown's values and attitudes to risk will affect her interpretation of any of the published evidence that we share with her. Equally, how we present the evidence and communicate risk to her may affect her preferences and concerns. Documentation of information shared between the patient and health professional, will affect the integrity and the completeness of the patient health record. So how the published evidence is used will depend quite crucially on factors unique to this patient, in particular the patient's values and preferences. I hope this diagram shows that in order to manage this patient, we need access to the published evidence and the skills to make sense of it in this particular context. We need good quality patient health records from which information can be retrieved easily. And we need good clinical and communication skills with which to elicit our patient's perspective and communicate the evidence. As electronic health records become more sophisticated, it is possible that there will be greater opportunities to integrate the published evidence with the patient health record, but this is limited at present. In particular, there is a need for bite-sized chunks of evidence to be delivered to the patient health record in the form of reminders and alerts, in a way which involves minimal effort on behalf of the clinician. Please click next to move on to slide 8. We will now focus on the use of information in the published literature to support evidence-based medicine. To summarise, evidence-based medicine, as described by Sackett, is seen as a 5-stage process which begins with the identification of information needs and the formulation of questions, and ends with the implementation of best evidence in practice. The steps are shown on the slide, so I'll let you read them. The apparent simplicity of this 5-stage paradigm conceals considerable complexities related both to the interpretation of the evidence itself and, perhaps even more importantly, the implementation of the evidence in practice. Please click on to slide 9. At an individual level, the whole process of evidence-based medicine demands that clinicians adopt a positive attitude to using evidence and a reflective approach to practice, which includes a willingness to be sceptical of accepted wisdom and to change practice if the evidence supports this. Reflective practice is not the subject of this presentation, but is a crucial first step in the whole process of evidence-based healthcare. There is little research to help us to understand the complex psychological processes which might explain what motivates a clinician to identify and pursue answers to their questions, nor which type of interventions might promote the questioning behaviour on which evidence-based medicine depends. Now looking more widely, clinicians in primary care work within primary healthcare teams. Doctors, nurses, health visitors, managers, pharmacists, administrative staff, to name just a few. In the course of any illness episode, contributions by all of these professionals may impact on the journey that a patient experiences. What is becoming increasingly apparent in the research is just how complex the system that we call primary care is. Changes in practice in this environment depend heavily on cultural and organisational factors, and are at least as dependent on team relationships, social factors, and professional culture as they are on the strength of any evidence that exists. Face-to-face recommendations and interventions which are personalised, for example by local opinion leaders, are a more powerful force for change at a local level than even the highest quality national guidelines which are pushed out to clinicians who have not always asked for them. This may well have some important implications for how information services are organised. So the message is that we must ensure that information needs are recognised in the first place, and importantly, that having met the information need, the information is connected to real action which matters to patients. Please click on to slide 10. Although the implementation of evidence-based medicine does require high-quality information, the existence of such high-quality information is not sufficient. Put very simply, information needs do not necessarily translate into information-seeking behaviour, which in turn does not necessarily translate into information use. I will now describe what we know about information needs in primary care and what the implications might be for the delivery of information services in this context. Please click on to slide 11. I would now like you to take part in another interactive exercise. I know that many of the listeners today are either librarians or primary care professionals. I would like you to think back to the scenario we considered earlier, Mrs. Brown and her Barrett's esophagus. If you are a librarian or information specialist, think about why you may not have heard from her GP with the questions which were identified. If you are a health professional, think about why you may not have asked a librarian for help with your questions. You have 2 minutes in which to think of some ideas. So again, please use the Ask a Question facility to send them in. And once again, the line will go quiet while you do this.
Okay, that's 1 minute gone. And that's your 2 minutes up.
Okay, thank you once again for sending in your ideas. I'll run through some of those with you now. So people have mentioned that primary care staff may not see the value of training that is offered in literature searching. But there's a perceived addition to workload. No time, no resources. The GP might simply be unaware of the service, or there might be a practical problem, like, for example, the GP not knowing the email address of the librarian. The librarian may not be able to offer a convenient or timely response. And finally, though I'm sure a lot of you would question this, the GP may not believe that the librarian has the skills. So once again, thank you for taking part in that exercise, which I hope you found helpful. We're now going to have a look at what the literature has to say about GPs' questions. Please click onto slide 12. There has been very little research on the questioning behaviour of professionals in primary care other than that of general practitioners. Furthermore, the research on questioning behaviour of GPs has relied largely on prompting them in or after consultations with patients. This is likely to artificially inflate the number of questions generated compared to routine practice. However, the research suggests that GPs have at least one question per day and possibly up to two questions for every three patients seen. However, they rarely seek answers for their questions, and only 30% of their questions are ever followed up. The limited evidence on questions raised by nurse practitioners in primary care suggests that they may pursue a higher proportion of their questions. One study by Cogdill included interviews with 20 nurse practitioners and found that 85% of their information needs were pursued. GPs are more likely to pursue an answer to a question if they suspect an answer exists, or if the nature of their question is urgent. Please click next onto slide 13. GPs are very likely to answer a question by asking a colleague. Research has shown that although GPs are generally supportive of the notion of evidence-based medicine, only 5% feel that they should seek out primary literature and systematic reviews by themselves. Please move on to slide 14. McCall and colleagues carried out a questionnaire survey among 242 GPs who identified these as the major perceived barriers to practicing evidence-based medicine. The average GP consultation is only 8 minutes. Not surprisingly, GPs identify time as a barrier to practicing evidence-based medicine. Research has shown that GPs spend less than 2 minutes on average pursuing the answer to a question. Personal and organisational inertia were regarded as obstacles, as were fundamental problems with the evidence itself, in particular related to the interpretation of evidence in the primary care context, or gaps in the evidence. Attitudes of colleagues to evidence-based medicine were cited, although it could always be argued that it's easier to blame others. Lastly, GPs perceived that patients' expectations were not always in line with the evidence, and this posed some special challenges. Please click onto slide 15. Ely and colleagues analysed the obstacles encountered when attempting to answer doctors' questions using an evidence-based approach. They identified 59 obstacles in total. The investigators identified 6 barriers as being particularly important. Once again, time constraints are top of the list. Finding information was very time-consuming. GPs' questions were often vague or unstructured, and formulating precise questions was difficult. Choosing a search strategy and being confident when to stop searching were important. They also experienced frustration when an information resource which was thought to be an appropriate choice for a particular question was found to be inadequate. Finally, the interpretation of evidence was especially challenging when it involved synthesizing evidence from several different sources. Please click onto slide 16. We may have to accept that evidence-based medicine, as originally described by Sackett, takes too long for the busy GP or primary care nurse. It is impractical for most busy primary care professionals. An alternative is for clinicians to become adept at finding and using pre-digested or pre-appraised summaries of evidence which can be found quickly, to become a practitioner of evidence-based care, or to practice what has been called information mastery. Shaughnessy and colleagues describe the usefulness of information in terms of the relevance and validity of the information relative to the amount of work involved in finding it. This is often expressed as the usefulness equation and is shown on the slide. The most useful information is therefore the information which is most relevant, closest to the truth, and least effort to track down and digest. Please click on to slide 17. In other words, we need relevant knowledge at the right time, in the right place, in just the right amount, and in the right format. Please click on to slide 18. I will now present an example of an information service which I was involved in, the Imperial College Informaticist Project. I choose this example simply because it is the one I'm most familiar with. An evidence-based question answering service was established for GPs and practice nurses. It was one of 2 parallel projects which explored the role of a question answering service as a way of supporting evidence-based decision making. I was the clinical informaticist, a GP with training in evidence-based medicine, and I worked on this project half-time whilst continuing to practice as a clinician. The delivery of the service was analogous to a PATH lab. The questions were sent to me, and I was based in an academic department. I carried out a literature search and a critical appraisal and returned the answer to the questioner in the form of a clinical bottom line, a summary of the evidence, and a reference list. There was a strong research component to this work. We made detailed recordings of the processes involved, for example, the resources needed and the time taken to answer questions. We collected data about the number and types of question, how questions arose, and what the questioners would have done otherwise. We also found out how the answers were used in practice and how satisfied the users were with individual answers and with the service overall. Although practices were visited at the outset of the project, there was limited ongoing personal contact with participants. Telephone discussion between myself and the questioner was necessary to formulate the questions for about 13% of the questions asked. I used an explicit search cascade to answer the questions and the focus was on the academic rigour of the answer supplied. Please click next onto slide 19. 100 clinicians were invited to use the service, but only 34 wished to participate. Like previous studies, most of the questions were related to therapy. Perhaps not surprisingly, the project had its enthusiasts. For example, about a quarter of the questions came from one single group practice, and the two highest users generated 13 of the 60 questions. However, 12 of those who originally expressed interest in using the service posed no questions at all, and the rate of questioning was generally lower than we had anticipated. However, the service was highly valued by those who used it and provided answers to questions which would otherwise not have been pursued. Please click onto slide 20. The time-consuming nature of the searching and appraisal process has been reported in several studies, including a recent report by Verhoeven in the Netherlands, who, as a GP-qualified medical information specialist, also provided an evidence-based answering service along very similar lines to the Imperial project. We turned our questions round in 9 days on average, and more than 70% of questions were answered within 2 weeks. The half-time nature of the informaticist post needs to be borne in mind when interpreting this. All clinicians were asked to indicate the desired timescales for receipt of an answer to their queries. Obviously, requested turnaround times are likely to be influenced by what the questioner perceives the service is capable of providing. But results of this study and the Netherlands study suggest that many GP information needs can be adequately satisfied by a service which returns answers within 2 to 3 weeks. This probably corresponds to the time of a patient's review appointment in general practice. The message for those designing information services seems to be that there are two types of question. The first are those which require an answer here and now. In other words, within the 2 minutes that a GP may reasonably be expected to spend. For example, information delivered to the desktop, such as reminders or prompts in clinical systems, or very easily accessible internet resources with bite-sized messages. For many questions, a timescale of, say, 2 weeks may well be satisfactory. The literature on providing evidence-based responses to GPs' questions often places an emphasis on the need for high-speed return of responses to questions. But information services which are able to fit with a rhythm of review appointments in general practice may fulfil these needs almost as well. Although convenience is clearly important, and this may be one reason why colleagues are so often approached for answers, providers of information services need to consider the potential trade-off between a pragmatic answer delivered quickly and the quality of the information supplied. As we have already seen, the process of searching and critical appraisal is slow, especially if synthesis of several primary studies is required. Please click onto slide 21. Here are some examples of questions which were asked during our project. As I mentioned earlier, questions were not always well formulated. In 13% of questions, that they were vague or unstructured and had to be refined by discussion. So, does breast examination reduce mortality from breast cancer? Is quinine sulfate effective for nocturnal leg cramps? In a 73-year-old with osteoarthritis, does oral glucosamine reduce pain or slow the onset of disease? Please click onto slide 22. So, was the service valued? We relied on self-reporting of how answers would affect a patient's management, and made no attempt to verify this, but the results are encouraging. Services which supply GPs with information in a way which they can access and use easily can result in very real differences to patient care. Satisfaction with the relevance, timeliness, and clarity of the answers was high. 1 in 3 answers led to a reported change in management of a particular patient, and 1 in 2 answers would be used in managing future patients. There were many other positive spin-offs mentioned. For example, the answers promoted discussion, provided reassurance, led to new learning, encouraged further use of the service, or in one case led to consideration of a piece of research. Please click onto slide 23. I mentioned earlier that the Imperial project was one of 2 parallel projects. The second project was delivered in Basildon, and the 2 projects evolved in quite different ways. Some of the differences are shown in the table. The focus of the Imperial project was academically orientated. The focus of the Basildon project was service orientated. The Basildon team saw its role as facilitatory, using personal contacts to help identify questions. By contrast, our project was based on a model akin to a lab testing service. An answer was sent to a clinician whose job it was to then decide how to make use of it in the context of the patient concerned, just as they might have to decide what to do with a cholesterol test result. The Imperial project aimed to provide highly rigorous answers based on a thorough literature search and appraisal, using the library services of an academic research department when needed. The Basildon group focused on using easily accessible resources. The Basildon project was successfully integrated into a clinical effectiveness unit, enabled through the strong local links of the project leader. By contrast, none of the Imperial team were involved in a local service general practice, and this was certainly a disadvantage. A case study evaluation of the 2 projects, published by Tricia Greenhouse and colleagues, highlighted these 2 approaches as complementary and essential dimensions of a quality answering service. The evaluation concluded that to facilitate questioning behaviour, address questions competently, disseminate results effectively, and apply results in practice is likely to require both an academic connection and a service connection. Please click onto slide 24. The model is illustrated here. There are 2 axes, the horizontal one representing the facilitation of questioning behaviour, the vertical one showing the technical quality of answers. The desired position for an information service is in the top right quadrant, the aim being to generate questions from a wide range of practitioners and produce high quality answers that are actively implemented in practice. Please click on to slide 25. We identified earlier a number of barriers between clinicians and the evidence, which get in the way of primary care clinicians engaging fully with evidence-based practice. There are also barriers between clinicians in primary care and the information specialists. It is exceptionally rare for a general practice to have close working links with an information professional. Whilst many practices employ an information manager, this role tends to be a technical one, primarily focused on how computers and the electronic health record are managed in-house. For example, developing coding policies, managing security issues, or improving data quality in liaison with the practice manager. Information services such as those provided by librarians tend to be remote from the day-to-day reality of general practice. There is an obvious geographical divide, as they are traditionally located in the postgraduate library, But there is also a cultural divide, neither professional perhaps being fully aware of how the other one works or the potential for working more closely together. Please click on to slide 26. There needs to be a greater partnership between information professionals and clinicians in primary care to fully realise the potential of information services. Whilst delivery of information via the internet offers huge promise, there may be potential alongside web-based initiatives such as MELH for offering more personalised community-based services with an explicit aim of facilitating information-seeking behaviour and providing high-quality information which is tailored to the local primary care context. Fostering trust between provider and user of such information services is likely to be the key to success. Sue Lacey Bryant has written about the need for librarians to appreciate the culture of general practice if they are to succeed in shaping user-centered information services and contributing to efficient information management within primary care. She also points out the huge differences in organisational culture which exist between different practices. To those of us who work within primary care, this is very apparent and it poses special challenges to the design of information services. It is likely that flexibility will be required in what is on offer to practices. Work also by Sue Lacey Bryant on the use of outreach librarians in primary care suggests that practice librarians can stimulate greater use of information resources in general practice. And she identified, as in fact we did in our informaticist project, that information needs resulting from specific problems in caring for individual patients are the most common. This may have consequences for those providing such services, in that the ability to interpret the literature in a way which is appropriate to the clinical context would be extremely valuable. This is encapsulated in what Davidoff has described as the informationist, a professional with a solid understanding of information science and the essentials of clinical work. A path open to people from either a clinical or an information science background. There have been several successful examples of the integration of clinical medical librarianship into secondary care, in which the information specialist becomes an integral part of the clinical team. The time may have come to explore further the potential for developing similar services in primary care. Please click onto slide 27. In summary then, we have seen how great the needs are of primary care professionals for high quality information. We have looked briefly at evidence-based medicine in the context of primary care, in particular the fact that successfully implementing evidence is much more complicated than plugging a simple information gap. It has become clear that achieving the vision of evidence-based practice is unlikely if reliance is placed on individual practitioners seeking out and appraising evidence for themselves, partly because this is so time-consuming, but also because of the various other barriers which we discussed earlier. Please click on to slide 28. Despite these obstacles, getting evidence to where it matters can result in real changes in practice and is an important intervention in the primary care context. Exactly how to meet these information needs is difficult, but the design of information services needs to incorporate both the academic dimension, such as the academic rigour of the information provided, and the service dimension, incorporating the realities and complexities of day-to-day practice. It is likely that information specialists and primary care clinicians need to work in partnership, especially at a local level, in order to shape services which are flexible and capable of meeting local contextual needs. This is the end of the presentation. Thank you for listening. And as I mentioned earlier, a list of references is appended in slides after this slide at the end of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I'm going to pull us out of presenter mode now. There's a couple of questions that have appeared actually on the console, and then we'll try and answer those. And then if anybody has any more questions, we can do those talking rather than typing them in. So just bear with me while I do a couple of beeps. Okay, there, I can tell we're back because I can hear more people in the background there. Deborah, there were a couple of questions came in there about exactly what search cascade is that you mentioned around slide 18.
A search cascade is simply an explicit statement about which information resources would be approached in which order in the literature searching. So for example, our search cascade had at the top of it the Cochrane Library of Systematic Reviews. And whilst we acknowledged that some of the steps in the information cascade did not necessarily reflect superiority of evidence, so in other words, the step three and step four may have resulted in information of similar quality, it was an explicit way of going through, a systematic way of going through the various types of literature available, and something we were able to communicate with the users of the service. And I think in this sort of service, and the users get some confidence from knowing what system or what approach is being used to approach the literature.
Thank you very much. And there's also a couple of questions about your Imperial project that you did. One person's here asking whether the service continued beyond being the particular project or pilot that you were carrying out.
The answer to that question is no, it didn't. And this, I think, is one of the, well, this was clearly a limitation. It was an academic research project, and unfortunately, like a lot of such projects, did not evolve into an ongoing service. Towards the end of the project, we held training workshops with a number of local GPs, and filled with about six workshops to teach evidence-based medicine skills. But it wasn't continued as a service. And I think, as I mentioned in the slide earlier, we felt that the fact that none of us were involved in service general practice locally was a disadvantage in this respect. And the Basildon project, which evolved along slightly different lines to ours, but included close links between the project leader and other local practices, was able to incorporate itself into local primary care development in a clinical effectiveness unit. So the output of our project was a number of articles which were able to describe the process of setting up such a service, the types of questions that came in, the obstacles, difficulties and challenges of providing such a service, and some of the academic outcomes that I mentioned earlier.
Fabulous, thank you. Somebody else was asking, version of your project focused particularly on teaching practices, and the question was whether you selected participating practice in the same way or if you approached all sorts of practices.
We ran a very small pilot project initially with three practices, and that developed out of a sort of general practice journal club. But we let the 10-month project, which I referred to, in that we approached 100 clinicians, which were all clinicians of three primary care trusts. And so we didn't select practices for any particular quality or use of training practices. It was open to any practice in those PCTs.
Okay, thank you.
We didn't actually look at whether being a training practice has any implications for the likelihood of people using the service, but I know that some of Sue Lacey Bryant's work suggests that training practices, by the nature of the fact they're training practices, are more likely to generate information needs.
Okay. Thank you. There was another question here about how confident you would have been at critically appraising and presenting clinical bottom lines if you hadn't had clinical training. There was a feeling that the librarian wouldn't feel confident doing that because they haven't had that clinical training.
I think this is quite an interesting question, and it's perhaps quite difficult to answer in the sense that obviously I had had clinical training and it's quite hard for me to divorce myself from that. What I can say is that there were a couple of questions where it felt to me very useful that I have some clinical knowledge. For example, we had a question about the use of GTN ointment in healing anal fissures, and I summarised the evidence about that, but as a clinician was aware that the strength of ointment available in our British National Formulary was actually 10 times the strength of the ointment used in the trials, and so was able to add, if you like, a cautionary note to the clinician receiving the answer that if they were going to use this treatment, they would need to ask a pharmacist to dilute the ointment. I'm not... Lots of people, however, who run similar services would argue that a long clinical background is not required, in the sense that if it's a clinician asking the question, then you have a clinician there with whom you can enter dialogue about the clinical implications of the answer that you're providing. So there is a school of thought that would say that if an information specialist and a clinician are in dialogue, then between them they should be able to place the literature-based answer into a clinical context. I don't know if any other people on the line have any views on that.
Can I come in there?
Yeah.
As a librarian and medical librarian of long standing, I would not feel able to give the sort of critical approach, the final stage that you did,
right,
in your project, and I just would not have the confidence, nor the sort of assurance of my own knowledge. And there are very obvious things which I would miss because I haven't got clinical background, and also the whole sort of litigation thing. You know, it's not my responsibility to be clinically able, so therefore I could go a certain distance along what you did, but I'd have to stop at saying, This is the competent literature that I have found, but you have to appraise it in your own clinical setting. So someone with both qualifications would be ideal, but I haven't got both sides, and I think probably a lot of information scientists would feel the same.
Hi, as the person who actually asked that question, I feel exactly the same way as the previous speaker. I couldn't. I was just feel terrified at the prospect, and it's not my job to evaluate and there's the and make the decisions and give a clinical bottom line. And also there could be many different aspects of the case that aren't part of the question. So it's about feeding the information that you get through the answer into all the other information that's coming that they can't tell you when they were actually asking the question. That's what part of my problem with that is. I admire clinical librarians enormously, but I would feel very uncomfortable doing their job.
Would you not need to get the actual full article before you could clinically appraise it anyway? It might not be in your library.
Well, I think this is one of the decisions that has to be made if this sort of service is being delivered. In our example, we did obtain the primary research articles, including getting some really quite obscure articles from remote libraries, because we felt that the rigour of the answers was very important. But that was not the approach taken by the Basildon project, who were explicit in saying, we'll see what we can find, we'll find what's easy to find, and use the best that we can find and deliver that. So it's a slightly more pragmatic approach. And I'm not sure whether there has been any research. In fact, I'm pretty sure there hasn't been any research to help us to know how important it is to seek out everything that you can possibly find compared to taking a more pragmatic view. Going back to the whole issue about offering advice to clinicians, we were quite careful in making it clear that we were not going to tell them how to manage a patient. In other words, we were not going to give clear guidance, if you like, on exactly what the primary care clinician would do, because I agree with you that that is the clinician's responsibility, because the clinician has access to the information in the records and the patient's concerns and so on in a way that the information specialist doesn't. So we were quite clear in saying that what we would provide would be the clinical bottom line with a summary, and obviously the summary really has to be read alongside the clinical bottom line to because that would outline some of the shortcomings, if you like, of the evidence that we could find. And we didn't say this is what you should do, because in the same way that say a clinician will receive a lab result like a cholesterol level, they would have to interpret that in the light of all the other information that they have, and that was the model that we tried to mirror. In terms of librarians perhaps not being confident to can I ask, is it the lack of confidence in the critical appraisal element, or is it in the conversion of that critical appraisal into a clinical bottom line where you feel most uncomfortable?
From my point of view, it's a bit of both.
Right.
I'm happy doing a sort of a brief introduction in training people to critically appraise, but the stuff that they bring into any of these training sessions is much more than just what a p-value is. It's about interpreting the results as well as saying, well, that's the best standard treatment. So it's a mixture of both from my point of view.
Yes. What about some of the other people on the line? Does anyone else have any comments about which particular part of the process feels uncomfortable?
Go on. I feel that critical appraisal is something that, as librarians, that we can learn to do. But when I've done critical appraisal, I've often asked for help from somebody with subject knowledge in that particular area.
Yes.
And I think that's what is lacking.
Yes.
It's certainly not something that we have traditionally been trained to do. It's come in over the last few years, but I don't feel competent enough to, apart from, say, to be involved in a training course on it, to then go ahead and appraise for somebody else in a real clinical context. And I'm certainly not prepared to bring in a clinical bottom line. That I feel is way beyond my competence.
Right.
Here, here.
What I hope it to do is to find an example of someone else who's brought out a clinical bottom line. So I look on, that's what I'm relying on the sources for. The different sites on Nelly to say this is the clinical bottom line someone brought in this situation. But as this was pointed out at the beginning, it's a synthesis of these different sources then, and possibly some primary research as well. I'll bring it together, but I am not clinically competent then to make any conclusion about it, and I don't think I ever would be.
It maybe needs some kind of partnership approach. I mean, perhaps this is why the Basildon one works, because they're part of the clinical evidence unit. So perhaps once the librarian has done the search, has done as much appraisal as they can, if there's not an easy clinical bottom line, they would have colleagues within their service that they can talk to in interpreting and producing that bottom line.
I think that's right. And I think the trouble you see is that I think a lot of GPs and primary care nurses would also say that physically appraising and synthesising evidence from lots of different sources is certainly for a lot of clinicians in practice today something that they were not trained to do either. I know this is changing, and evidence-based medicine and critical appraisal are becoming important medical student topics, but certainly for a lot of primary care clinicians currently, I think they actually feel very similar to you librarians, that they also feel that they don't have the skills to appraise the literature, which then leaves us with the question of, well, this seems to be something that is quite important, and therefore how do we go about doing it? How do we get this done? And I think, I mean it's absolutely clear that, as I said in the talk, that small bite-sized messages of evidence that is clear-cut can be delivered to primary care, potentially in different ways, via internet or reminders and prompts to the medical record. But there remains a large body of literature which is perhaps a bit more difficult to interpret, a bit less clear-cut, where I think there is perhaps a need for some dialogue with clinicians in primary care and information services to see how such how by working together some valuable output, valuable service can be developed that really helps patients, because at the end of the day that's what we're all in it for.
One way of doing it would be if a GP asks a specific question, then we try and answer it to our best abilities.
Yeah.
And if we could actually find the opportunity to talk to them directly about the answers we've found, to find out if they really have answered the question, if the GP then has pulled out the information they want. The problem is, of course, actually having that subsequent meeting. Most of the my contact is by email or possibly by telephone. Very little of it is sitting at a desk, looking at the material. And this comes back to the original problem of the lack of time thing. And the lack of actual physical face-to-face contact that is available.
Yes.
They don't get to me, and they find it difficult to fit me in, although I'm willing to go. That's my job, and I'm quite happy to go. They find it difficult to fit me in, apart from actually doing the email to me in the first place.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody's done some sort of comparison between the Attract version of the same service and the Imperial version of the service, and whether anybody's compared actually what people want, because it's two versions of exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
One's quick and dirty, and I think I've heard John Bessie sort of almost accept it as that. It's the nature of it is a bit quick and dirty because it's within 24 hours,
mm-hmm.
not dissing the amount of it, the quality of the information that's provided, but that's what it is. And also the 2 to 3 weeks turnaround for somebody doing a lot more in depth. And it'd be just interesting to see what people prefer, because if we're doing something because it's very much more academically rigorous, but what all they want is a quick and dirty, here's a summary of what systematic reviews were out there, then we need to start thinking about exactly what we're doing and who we're doing it for.
So that there hasn't been any formal evaluation of those two services back to back. But they do have quite different approaches, and of course, I mean, you could argue it's the Attract one that has actually carried on into a product. We felt quite strongly that the quality of answers was very central to what we were going to provide. A lot of this came from my own feelings as a clinician, which was that if I was going to use an information service, I would feel quite strongly that I would want confidence in what the information that was coming back to me. But I think it may be possible that there are different stakes, if you like, for different sorts of questions.
Yeah.
And that for some questions, a GP might be very happy with what you call a quick and dirty approach. But for other questions, something that's perhaps more valid or more reliable would be important. So quite how you would incorporate that into service, I'm not sure. But clearly if one is looking at developing a local guideline or a PCT level policy, then one wants to make quite certain that the quality of information is very high. It is quite clear that in the clinical setting, some questions, if I say more weighty than other questions, I don't know what other people think about this issue.
from my own experience, you actually interpret that as you go along, and the sort of iterative practice of most librarians dictates that, because you go back with a certain amount of information and say, is this enough? Do you want more? And so you've done the first sort of quick and dirty, and then you go back and they say, ah, well, it hasn't quite answered it, and you go off and do the more thorough and do the next step, go down your cascade, basically.
Yes, sure.
But what we'd like to do is train the GPs to do the first bit of a cascade themselves, of course. That's sort of the ideal, I think, if they're actually going to learn to do this as part of their everyday medicine, rather than having to involve the librarian personally. The service is developed to let them take us to go a certain way down that way.
There's also the whole hideous chestnut to crack of how to get the people to actually ask the right questions to begin with. Even with your group of participants, half of them didn't actually ask any questions at all. And you've said in your presentation there is at least one question a day, if not one question per patient, for goodness sake. So there's that aspect of it as well. Work out, obviously we need to work out how we answer it or not and present it and within the time scale and the method you go about dealing with the question, but actually getting them to ask the questions to begin with is a significant thing.
That's an area I'm quite interested in myself, because I think that is largely around reflective practice, and I've got an educational role, so I see that as being quite important, and I haven't been able to find very much information at all on interventions that can actively, if I say change someone who isn't a person who poses lots of questions into someone who is a person who poses and follows up a lot of questions. So I think that's quite interesting.
I suppose you can you support the people who are convinced of the need of you preach to the converted to begin with, and then what about the people who are probably never going to change their practice later? Tricky one.
I'd like to ask the librarians that are on the line, how common is it for you to actually, if a GP or a practice nurse were to contact you with an information need or a question, how common is it for you to follow up what actually happens with the information that you provide?
Time doesn't allow it, unfortunately. I always mean to do some sort of tell us what you thought of this evaluation thing, but having seen a few of them in practice in previous jobs, just think, no, very few people actually send them back. It's only people who say, oh yeah, that was all fine, that send them back.
It's the bane of our life. The library service is satisfactory. It doesn't mean anything. People don't actually say critically what the library service has done for them. They just say it's fine.
Because actually getting a big pile of abstracts is often sufficient, I think, for people. Oh yes, I went out and looked for the answer, read the abstract, and that's fine now. The amount of follow-up of actually people getting the articles is another stage again. Maybe just I'm having a slightly warped view, because it seems that a lot more of my work comes from practice nurses who are doing short courses than from GPs who've got questions coming from a particular patient. But maybe that's just the nature of the services I've managed to evolve over time. Does that sound familiar, or is that?
Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah, personally.
Okay.
And I forgot what I was going to say. The way I tend to follow up people is actually if I find something else that might be relevant to them, and I say, are you still interested? And they very often say yes, which either means they haven't found the information in the first place, or it's something that's ongoing. And that's, you get a very positive response to that, in a real positive way, rather than just, yes, it's satisfactory. But whether they've actually done something with the information is difficult to tell.
Okay, it'd be interesting to find out how many GPs and primary care clinicians are actually listening and taking part in this. Because obviously I think it's a very pertinent thing for librarians, but are primary care clinicians finding out about how they're acting and the ways that they behave? I would somehow suspect there's very
no one's answering you. I'm afraid I can't tell from the questions that have come in.
I think we've only had one or two people who were
healthcare practitioners rather than librarians on the call.
Right.
So maybe that's a subject of a future call.
Yeah. Therein lies the topic of future research, perhaps, yes.
by the way, Deborah, you mentioned you were particularly interested in teleconferencing as a means. I'm sort of toying with this idea myself. Fran, I will be getting in touch with you. It's either here.
Okay.
Right. Well, I was quite interested to see... I've never done anything like this before myself, so I was just quite interested to see how it works as a vehicle, if you like, for sharing information, but also I put those interactive exercises in just to see if that, you know, got people using the Ask a Question facility and so on, and certainly everybody has participated really well with that, so that's great. I mean, any feedback, there is a feedback.
That brings me to what I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, at the end of the presentation, so I would be very interested to have your feedback.
If you click through the reference list, there's three pages of references. If you click through to the end, there's the little feedback button, and any comments you've got, you know, positive or things that could do with improving or whatever, is really useful to us for each time we run one of these sessions. I'm very conscious of the time because we've now got to about 11:15. Are there any last questions before we finish up? Deafening silence. That's wonderful. Well, I'd just like to thank you very much, Deborah, for leading this. It's been a very, very interesting talk. And if you could just click through and fill in your feedback, then that's it. Thank you all very much for taking part. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.